Family flowers only, thanks to flowers.ie. Five-star luxury flowers, approved by you, delivered with care.
Before we get into the heart of today's episode, I'm delighted to welcome our new sponsor, flowers.ie. Now, given the name of this podcast, it's a partnership that just makes sense, especially around Mother's Day. If you're looking to send something special, these guys are the highest rated florist in Ireland with over 15,000 five-star Trustpilot reviews. They do proper luxury flowers and fast and efficient express delivery in County Dublin and surroundings, as well as next day delivery to all counties. But the absolute game changer is their video approval. They actually send you a video of your arrangement before it goes out, so you know it's just right. Mother's Day can be a tender one for many of us. Whether you're celebrating your mammy, remembering her, or placing flowers somewhere special in her honour, it can be a really meaningful way to mark the day. Head over to flowers.ie and use the promo code 5STAR for €5 off your order. Because it's 5STAR luxury flowers, approved by you, delivered with care. Hey everyone, welcome back. This week I'm joined with Rachel Gotto and I'm delighted to have her. Rachel, we met not very long ago at all. You joined me on one of my workshop days and it was such a pleasure to have you. And I was like, come on, we need to sit down and have a chat. Rachel, I suppose, has a couple of titles, which I will tell you about. One is you are, I suppose, primarily a clinical hypnotherapist. You're also a grief educator and you work in the corporate environment. You are a trauma and grief and crisis coach, and also a best-selling author and a lived experienced speaker. A lot of titles. But before, I suppose, we get to how you have done all of that, I would love to just meet the human Rachel who brought you into all this work. And so I would love to go back a little bit. And obviously this podcast is a lot about grief and loss. And if we go back, you are from Cork originally. I would love to hear a little bit, I suppose, your first experience of loss really was your brother Dominic. Could you bring me back and tell me a little bit about, you know, where you come from and how your brother passed Dominic?
Yeah, of course. And thank you.
You're welcome.
So originally, my parents were headed for New Zealand and they sold up everything and bought a boat. And there were three of us born by then, not me and not Dominic. And so they set sail for New Zealand, arrived in a place called Glander in West Cork one morning early and were captivated simply by the landscape, the people, the way of life there, and they loved it. So Dominic and I were actually born on those shores.
Okay.
And eventually we moved into a house and we took up life there and my father began a small business. And so Dominic and I were what we call the Irish twins.
Yeah.
You know, there was only really just a year between us and we did everything together. We began school together the same day. And so we were joined at the hip in so many ways. And I relied on him a lot. He was the boy and he was 1 year older than me and I was the youngest and the only girl. So basically, we were co-joined emotionally and we went through our schooling together. We were always sort of checking in with each other. But there came a time when both of us wanted to spread our wings. And he went west and I went to Dublin. And when I say he went west, he went sailing and became a delivery skipper because we grew up on the sea. We were very, you know, akin to that environment. We sailed, we fished, we caught our own food. So we were quite sort of robust and resilient in that way. I had dreams of being famous and I had dreams of living in a city where it was all sophisticated and just loved the whole idea of that. And living in the countryside, it seemed so amazing and magical. So I went to Dublin and he went west to the sail and Caribbean. And we came back, both of us came back to Ireland at about the same time. And I began a little business on the pier. I began a little restaurant and he came back and he wasn't really sure but what he was going to do. But he had changed. There was something wrong. And he was a very private person. So he didn't say anything for a very long time. But then he disclosed that he actually was suffering from bowel issues. And it led to investigations, which led to a diagnosis of very advanced colorectal cancer. And he was only about 26 and I was, you know, ending 24. You know, we were kind of that year and a half. And it was such a shock because somehow, you know, when you're young, you feel invincible. You're poised at the start of life. And this was something that was simply a major blot on that beautiful beginning of our lives. And very quickly, it transpired that he wasn't going to survive. He didn't want to have conventional treatment. He wanted to try with diet and all sorts of other therapies. And he did. Unfortunately, he ended up having to go to the hospitals in Dublin and have surgery. And his demise was slow, but it was marked and it was continuous. And when he was diagnosed and when he was becoming ill, I just moved into gear. I rented out my business and I became his companion and his nurse and his carer. It was like I had no other choice. That was what I had to do. It was like an inherent program. So I stayed with him for those 2 years. And as the time came and when he became more and more ill, I learned how to administer his medications. I learned how to take care of his wounds. I learned how to make sure that his morphine pump was working and how to give a bolus. A lot of things that were way beyond my years and my capacity at the time. I didn't know it. I was so bent on helping Dominic and being there for him that I didn't have the capacity to look and see, is this something that is going to have long-reaching effects for me? And I just kept at it. It was my role. And I was taking on my role and I was never not going to do my role. And I stayed with him for 2 solid years. And I remember one particular day, we had actually been going to a clinic in Germany, where we'd been a couple of times for particular treatments. And a letter arrived in the post and Dominic was in his bed. And I said, there's a letter for you. And he said, would you open it? And I scanned it very quickly. And all I really picked up was, dear Mr. Bendon, I'm very sorry. And about the last line or so, which was, maybe it would be better if you fell into a coma. There is really nothing very much that we can do. And that they're not the exact words, but that was what I received. And it was like, it's over. It's done. And he said, what does it say? And I couldn't say those words. I said, Dominic, I'm so sorry. And his response to me was, it's okay. We tried. And he was so young. And I know that he had suffered so deeply and he had had to do all that soul searching work as a very young man. I remember seeing him in the garden one day looking out to sea. He lived at my mum's house and he was looking out to sea. And I wanted to break in and say to him, what are you thinking? Because my fear is that you know you're dying. And my fear is that you're terrified. But I never said it and I never asked because there was a bubble between us that I knew if I ever asked that question that I would simply dissolve myself emotionally. And I kept that stiff upper lip as a very young girl. And I carried him to the threshold and I held his hand and my mum on the other side as he began to take a less breath and a less breath and a less breath. And at the time of his death, and I hear people say this a lot, and you may have experienced it yourself, there is something so sacred in that moment. There is something so rarefied and unique that you could never really describe it. But there was this beauty there when he passed, when he took his last breath, that it kept me for quite some time. It was like it was a gift back. It helped me to go through the funeral and it helped me to go through the process. But then the ugliness and the realness and the rawness and the the truth about it all started to slip in. And I had seen things as a very young woman that maybe I would have been better off not seeing. You know, sorry, Dominic, but I allowed myself to see you sometimes in the worst possible place that still has actually long-reaching effects on me, if I'm not careful. And it's about not knowing, isn't it? And it's about we're brought forward to do these things. I will never regret caring for him, but I do regret that I didn't know that I didn't have to shoulder all of that myself. And our doctor said to me, "Are you sure you can do this, Rachel? Are you sure? This is not going to be pretty." And I was like, you know, determined young woman, of course I'm going to do this. And of course I will. I can handle anything.
Yeah.
But my nervous system didn't know that it couldn't handle everything.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting.
Mm.
I, you know, cared for my sister too. By God, it didn't matter if my whole body was about to collapse. I'm like, doesn't matter. I must go on.
Yes.
It's like...
I will go on.
Yeah. It's just the way you describe it. I'm like... Like if I was about to drop dead, I was like, doesn't matter. Like this is like my vocation. It literally felt like I will do this and nothing would dream of... The thought wouldn't have even entered my head that maybe you shouldn't. No, thanks.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
It's similar, isn't it?
Very, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I don't know. And it's like it comes from within. It's like they're your blood. You know, and I often said that like when my sister died. I remember thinking like it feels so different to anything, any loss that I've ever experienced before, because I was like, it's my blood. Like I just, if you hurt, I hurt.
Mm-hmm.
You bleed, I bleed. You know, that's how it felt.
And I'm coming with you.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm coming with you on this journey as far as I can.
Yeah. Yeah. Until you get to the door almost.
Yeah.
So obviously, you know, that was probably the most significant loss up until that time in your life. And you obviously then had stepped into the world of grief. Obviously you had more loss to come. What was the, I suppose, that first experience of grief when Dominic was gone and the silence and the dust settles? What was that like for you at that age and that time in your life?
My body was programmed to do nights, you know, to be awake at night. So I found it extremely difficult not to show up at Dominic's. I was programmed to be caring. So the loss of the role was enormous. Staying at home with no purpose at this time was horrific. And I remember the loneliness and the isolation of my tears. I remember crying in my bed, and I had met my partner at that time, Nick, and I remember that his hugs couldn't touch my pain. They couldn't soothe them, because although he was there and he was present, he didn't know the pain, because it was my pain of losing Dominic, my childhood companion. So no matter how much he tried to soothe me, I was alone in it, but also I kind of wanted to be alone in it, because it was a rarefied pain. It wasn't a shared pain, although he wanted to share my pain. It wasn't a pain I could share. And this, I've described it before, and I'm sure some people will recognize this. You keep trying to rewrite the ending of the story. Your nervous system keeps trying to tell a different ending. And of course, the truth keeps coming in. And so you have this battle with, has it really happened? Is this the truth? Is this what happened to us? And then it floods in again, and it is. So I just had this kind of internal battle. And also, when you look around the world, when you're grieving and when you're bereft and when you're in such loss, you're looking for clues around you to see, is anyone else doing this like me? Does anyone else feel like me? And generally, we didn't speak about anything.
Mm. This was the 90s.
This is the 90s. We didn't have a language.
No.
In fact, once the funeral and the rituals were done, then you were on your own, really.
Game over.
Yeah, it was game over. It was a very, very confusing time. And You know, Nick and I got married a year after Dominic died, actually. We had told him we were going to get married and he was very pleased about that. And I remember the day of a wedding, the rector asking me, how will we incorporate Dominic? And I couldn't have his name said because I knew that I would simply collapse. I was battling with such pain and I was so happy to be married, but the pain I was carrying, I was simply holding it together.
Mm.
And when I look back at her, Rachel, then, God, I just think, oh my God, I wish that I could have given you some soothing and comfort and support. You know, we hold it together a lot.
Yes, but I mean, it was your first steps, if you will. Like, it was your first, it didn't matter what soothing was offered to you, you needed to walk that and learn how to walk.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Nick, your husband, your new companion, if you will, you know.
Mm.
You guys got married and you were expecting your first baby in 1998. Mm. And you were on the sea because was Nick into the waters as well, into sea life?
Yes, he and I met. He came into the harbour in his boat.
Okay.
And he came into my restaurant and ordered a burger.
No way.
Yeah. And it's really just, I always remember that day because when I met him, I heard his voice before I met him. And I remember thinking, gosh, that's an interesting voice. And as it happens.
Where was he from?
He was actually a bit like me, half English, half Irish, English family, but born in Ireland. Yeah, blend. And I just knew he was going to be significant. I knew it the minute I met him. And so we actually together began a scuba diving business quite a while after we met. And so I had learned how to skipper the boat through him and I had learned how to scuba dive through him. So it began a passion of mine, which I'll tell you a little bit more later. But actually, we got married in December and by January I was pregnant. And by July, the 24th of July, 1998, I was quite pregnant. So I wasn't diving. He was a very quietly spoken, unassuming, but had a very rich personality, very confident, but quiet, very, very tall man. With a unique voice, and he was incredibly gracious and incredibly thoughtful and incredibly ambitious, actually, quietly. And he had done a degree in psychology in Trinity, and then he decided he wanted to become a fisherman. And he pioneered all sorts of ways of fishing, and he did a lot of pioneering work with the UCC, for breeding scallops in captivity and also conservation of stocks of the sea. So he was a forward-thinking man.
Okay.
He was 14 years older than me. I was 23, 24. I'm not very good with ages, I always forget. But I was 23, 24 when I met him. And, you know, he was in his late 30s.
Okay.
Yeah. We just had an affinity, connection that was very gentle, but he brought out parts of me that I don't think ever would have been brought out.
He just felt right.
Yeah, he just felt right. And we had a very deep connection.
So you are heavily pregnant in July.
Mm.
And can you bring me to, I suppose, the day that you're out on the sea and what actually happened, if you're able?
Of course. I wasn't supposed to go on the boat. We had 11 divers booked. And I was up at the house and Nick was readying himself for taking the divers. And he actually said to me, if you took the boat, I could dive because they go in twos. And he had 11 divers. And I said, oh no, I'm supposed to do something with Emily and Haley. And then he just said, would you? And it was a beautiful day, which is, as you know, is unique in Ireland. It was absolutely gorgeous July. And I said, go on. I said, go down, get the boat ready and I'll come down. And so literally I jumped onto the boat basically as everybody was ready to go. There was one other wife on board with one of the other divers. And the only thing I remember hearing him say was, oh, it's not calibrating. And then I heard him say, oh, it is. It seems to be working now. That's all I never thought anything about it. So we took the boat out, and it was a wreck called the Kowloon Bridge, which is quite close to the coast off Castletowns. And he found the wreck, put the shot line down, and all the divers went in. They go in two by two backwards over. So all divers in the water. And what you do is then you bring the boat up above the sun so you can see down on the water to see if anyone surfaces. So it's procedure. So I moved the boat. There was one other person on board with me. And very soon I noticed an arm waving in the water, and I brought the boat alongside, and somebody shouted up from the sea, Nick's in trouble. He's convulsing on the bottom, and get a chopper. So that moment was almost still in my mind because I'd heard the word Nick. I knew what to do. And I did what I had to do. I didn't falter in what I was supposed to do. But I remember sort of having two conversations, getting on the radio, Channel 16, calling a Mayday, asking for chopper support, asking for boat support, and explaining what had happened. And on the other hand, I'm having this conversation. Is it Nick? Is it couldn't be Nick? Is it can't be Nick? He's the most all of this like whisper conversation going on. And then, of course, having to go through the procedure of alerting the divers on the seafloor that there's an emergency, that they must come up, which is actually revving the engine three times out of gear, and so on and so on and so on. I managed to complete all of that all the time, knowing that it was my husband. And very soon, some divers came to the surface and we were able to say he's down there somewhere. And I knew we had a 3-minute window. And I'm speaking on the radio to the chopper and Valencia and the radio people, and I'm counting down the minutes. I know how much time I have. And I knew in my heart of hearts. And very soon I saw that he had been brought to the surface. And I wasn't sure if he was breathing or not. It was difficult to get him on board. We had a very high freeboard, which means we were high above the water, but something happened in me and I left the wheelhouse and I went out and helped them, and I just reefed him onto the deck and cut his neck seal. And then I tried to begin CPR, and I knew it wasn't a good thing, but they took over obviously as divers, and we had oxygen on board. And I went back into the wheelhouse and I was getting an ETA on the chopper, and I split inside me that day. Just something went away. One part of me went away. And what I would say now, looking back, is one part of me went to be safe, because the reality of what I was experiencing was so horrific and so raw and so nasty that I probably would have, I don't know, I imagine I would have collapsed or something, but I didn't. The RNLI boarded us and they asked to take over the boat. And I said, no, I'll bring her home. And Nick had actually been choppered off the boat and I wasn't allowed to go with him because I was pregnant. So I watched and saw as that bird flew far away from me in the sky and the sound receding. And I knew I'd a journey back to Glandore, back to the pier, back, and then a long drive to Cork Airport, which would be an hour and a half, 2 hours. I managed to radio and get my brothers to meet me. And the divers on board, of course, were helpful. Everybody was helpful. I had an RLNI crew member on board with me. And we got there and I just jumped in a car. My brother brought me to the hospital. But I was bargaining all the time. If I can get there, if I can get there, if I can get there, maybe he's still alive, maybe he isn't. Just this constant barrage in my head. I think my brother knew, because I asked him, could we get the police to clear the traffic? Could we get there quicker? And he said, no, we'd only be wasting our time, you know. And when we got there, I queued at the window, like everybody else. I was so calm. And I said, hello, my name's Rachel Carter. My husband was brought in by helicopter. And he was waiting for me. And the next thing, there was a hand on my shoulder and I was pulled out of the queue and brought around to the side by a nurse. And I said to her, how is he? And she said, I'm so sorry, he didn't make it. And then I went in to see him. And I became very practical. I'm looking back at her now again and I'm thinking, how did you become so practical? I didn't break. I didn't wail. I didn't make any sound. And then the family started coming and his parents came and his daughters came. And my heart breaks for them. They were 10 and 12. I was very close to them. And I think I heard that I took care of everyone, that I made sure everybody was doing okay. And it was late in the night then, and I went home. And I remember requesting that my best friend would be at the house. And we just sat and we drank wine. I was pregnant, but we drank wine. And then, of course, we had to run into the preparations. There was an inquest and there was a postmortem and there was all of that. Those first few hours and days after that, it was, there's not really words. I'm sure you know how I mean it. And people watching and listening will know there aren't really words. There's a funny air that's around when there's tragedy and trauma and so much horror that everybody kind of almost whispers and goes around because there, it's like you can't break what's happened. It's so fragile that peace is quiet is the only thing that just about keeps us all together in that. That's my memory of it.
Mm. Unimaginable, the suddenness, and just like even think back, it sounds like something you'd see in a movie, you know. Mm. You're pregnant, you're bringing the boat back, he's off into the distance. It's just, it doesn't feel like real life, does it?
No, I actually have said before, thank you for that. I have said I felt as if I was playing a part in a movie. You've just reminded me. I felt as if I was acting in a movie that I was starring in,
yeah,
of my own life. It was so surreal. And it interests me how I was able to do all of that, because it wasn't something that I had to force myself. I did it. It was there. And, you know, survival instinct and survival mechanisms are so sophisticated. And my brain clearly knew that if the full import of that was allowed to come all in one rush, I would definitely have collapsed and dissolved and been very ill. And I liken the sophistication of our nervous systems a bit like ABS braking in a car. If you slam on your car in these modern brakes on these modern cars, it goes da 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 da. It doesn't stop you straight away. And grief is the same. It comes in amounts that we can manage. The psychology understands how much you can manage and gives you as much rawness and horror and grief as you can manage in that moment. And then you slip into another, you know, aspect of it, like maybe numbness or sleeping, or it is kind of a funny phase. I don't know if you remember that yourself, but it we don't feel the full effect of it in one go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't think anyone can say that they did. Yeah.
Mm.
It needs to settle slowly.
Mm, it comes in slowly. So our brains and nervous systems are there to keep us alive, keep us breathing, keep us safe. And it's a bit like the freeze fawn sort of mode that we go into. We go into freeze mode, and that's why we have numbness in grief. That's why we have some parts of us that we then cry and we're feeling it really immensely, and we you know, cry and wail, and then we go into another mode. Because it's self-protective. It's a very interesting phenomena that we are given innately. And I think that if we were allowed to understand the full import of our losses and our horror in one moment, we would dissolve. We would disappear.
Yeah.
Because we have to stay alive. And that's what's really interesting. Our whole bent is that we must stay alive. We don't want to sometimes be around because of we've experienced such pain and horror. But actually, the innate drive is to remain alive. And look at Nicola. That's my daughter. She was in my tummy. You know, she stayed there. I didn't lose her. And my actions were not commensurate with holding on to a baby safely, believe me. I lost all care. You know, I was disassociated from the pregnancy following Nick's death. I was completely disassociated. I was not, I didn't have the energy that, or the capacity to imagine even giving birth, never mind being a mum at that level. And yet she hung in there and stayed alive and stayed cooking, for want of a better word, until it was her turn, time to come out. Now, she was really late and it was a very traumatic birth. But however, she preserved herself.
How much do you think being pregnant maybe changed how you grieved? You know, do you think, I know you said you totally disassociated, but at the same time, maybe that subconscious knew you were pregnant. You obviously kept going yourself to deliver this baby. And what is it like to be pregnant, heavily pregnant on your first child and to lose your husband? What is that like?
It's scary. Very frightening. My body grew more after his death because it was the latest stages of the pregnancy. And I remember feeling Nicola move inside me and being terrified of her movement. I was so shocked and traumatized by what I had been through and seen that night that it activated a very deep, visceral fear in me. I was scared of life at that point in time. I had a desperate fear of the dark. Now, I did have a childhood fear of the dark. I've always been nervy of the dark, but this was a visceral fear of the dark. It was like the dark had become evil to me. I could not see. I think it was because I could not see. I could not see my future. I could not see what this child was going to look like or what a family indeed was looking like now. And I was so exhausted by everything. I simply wanted to be alone. I just wanted to be alone. And I remember somebody came to see me and it was really very, very transformative. A woman whose husband had drowned when she was pregnant, heard about me. She'd written a book. She was a sailor. And she had come to see me within weeks of Nick being dead. And she spent the afternoon with me in my house. And she was just matter of fact. And that matter of factness gave me some calmness because she was one person who did know what potentially I was feeling. And she said, you know, it won't always be like this. You are going to recover. And I was sort of enthralled by her words. And she gave me her book. And I remember going to bed and reading her book. And it just pulled me into another world. It pulled me into another place. It was similar to my story, but it pulled me away from the horror and the emptiness of living in a home that used to be a family and now it's just me and my pregnant belly. Now, I had support and people were around, but at the end of the day, I closed that door at night and I had to live with myself. And so this, it was so terrifying that I just distracted. I went to places that weren't me. I went to places that were nothing to do with me. I read quietly. And I think I shared with you before, and I ate jam sandwiches. It was the only thing that seemed to give me comfort was jam sandwiches. So a book and a jam sandwich. But an eerie calm, I realize. And the eerie calm was that I was stunned, like I was punch drunk. I was numb. I was traumatized. And I remained that way for a very long time.
So I suppose Nicola arrives, any new mother, a new baby brings a lot of emotions and change and chaos. And that's if you're just on your baseline day, nothing else going on in your life, it's really hard. you've just lost your husband. I imagine it was extremely hard in those late nights. And even just, I imagine, the sadness for her, for Nick. Did you feel that, or were you comfortably numb for some time afterwards as well?
I don't think I felt anything akin to compassion for her. I had a deep instinctual love of her. I know that. I know that I would have walked on coals for her. However, it was too much for me.
Yeah.
It was just way too much.
Mm-hmm.
But I did it. And I kept going day in, day out. She was a very, very fractious baby. She was clearly, now looking back, very traumatized. She'd lived in a soup of adrenaline and cortisol from the 24th of July until her birth. She had a mother who was quite ill. She had a mother who was traumatized and sick, and she had a mother who was drinking wine.
Mm.
And so when she came to this planet, when she landed, she was very, very tolerant. That's the only thing I can think of saying. I was going through the motions. And we, Nicola and I have talked about this. I've had to apologize to her, I think. I felt I needed to apologize to her for the, you know, the, as I called it, the dodgy parenting. It was very sketchy, very dodgy parenting. However, I did everything. I looked after her. I changed her. I minded her. But, you know, the lights were on in me, but there was no one home. And the noise she made traumatized me. When she screamed, I just wanted to weep. The noise, to me, her cry sounded like a wail of grief, and I couldn't bear it. It was touching a raw nerve in me that was way too beyond what I was able to take at that time. So it was very sketchy, very just elemental getting through. And yes, you know, being a first-time mom, but yet being bereft at the same time, it's very complex. And I look back at her, me, and I can only say, how on earth did you get through? Like, how did you go from year to year? Because it, as you know, it's not just a few weeks. And Nicola was very sick. She had a birthmark that meant her eyesight and one of her eyes didn't develop, and she was going blind in that eye. And I had to be in Crumlin every week, and I had to be in the Bonds in Cork every morning for a urine test. And I had a crash one morning, and I walked into the hospital with Nicola still intact, didn't say a word to any of the nurses that I'd just come through a crash. And my car was crashed on the side, and I just got a taxi and carried on. I just had this rote carrying on. No awareness that I could stop and cry on the pavement and ask somebody to come and take over. Just didn't occur to me.
It's like the whole, your whole life then after that just felt like one big car crash. And even when you had a crash, you're like, that's not even that big of a deal.
It didn't touch my nervous system. That's just a crash. You just walk away from it, carry your baby down the street to the hospital.
And not even mention it. Isn't that bizarre when you think about it?
It's quite mad.
yeah but it's just survival, as you say. That's the body doing its job, keeping you alive. You didn't have time to sit down and dissolve. Mm. As you say.
Mm.
You then, I suppose, began to become symptomatic, and I suppose symptoms started to come physically. Mm. For you. Mm. In those couple of years after Nicola was born, what began to happen?
Just very strange things. And again, I should have thought they were strange, but I didn't, because I could not sleep. I had what we now know is really bad PTSD, so I was unable to sleep. Nicola couldn't sleep, so we were just like operating in this zone of needs must. And so I remember the first time I went to the shop, jumped back into the car, and just went to kind of move the gear stick, and my hand just didn't do it. And I was like, why can't I? And then it just passed. So just didn't do that. Didn't think about it again. One day I was driving on one of the back roads home, and I suddenly had this compulsion to drive on the wrong side of the road and stick my head out the window. And just kind of like, you know, corrected and didn't think anything of it. And so those little things were starting to happen. And I'm sure people listening going, why would you not but remember so much had happened so that it, I just put it all down to the experience of what I was living within. And it came to the point where I lost the use of my left leg at night when Nicola would cry. She never slept. So I ended up crawling to her room. And it never occurred to me, this is bonkers. You need to crawl. Your leg won't work. So this was going on for quite some time. And I remember one night I had what I now know was a tonic-clonic seizure in the night. My arm shot up above my head and I remembered nothing and I came to. And the real crux came. Nicola was, I think, about 4 or 5. She was sitting on her little plastic chair with her little plastic table in the kitchen and I was going to make her breakfast. And my arm shot up above my head. I just put the kettle on and I remember nothing else. And I came to with Nicola sitting on my chest, screaming at me, don't die, don't die. And I was so confused and I had no idea what had happened to me. But I said, Nicola, can you get the phone, ring grandma and tell her to get over here? And actually, I'd put the phone in the wrong place. It was one of those, and she couldn't get it. But eventually, between the two of us, we got it together and we called my mum. And she immediately called a local doctor and they arrived together and an ambulance was called immediately. And I was taken to Cork. And it was very quickly diagnosed and I was told I had a thing called an AVM, which is an arteriovenous malformation of the brain. So basically, it's a congenital rapidly growing tumor that is benign, but it... some of them are operable, and but yours happens to be the worst grade possible. And because of the location of it and because of how it is, it's inoperable. And you have a couple of years maybe, but you need to put your affairs in order and take care of your daughter's future. And again, luckily I had PTSD, I think, because the full import of it didn't really go in, truthfully. It was almost like, ah, another thing. Don't worry, we'll overcome it almost, you know. But it was, that was the truth. And I was sent home. I wasn't kept in very long. I was only in there given a loading dose of sodium valproate, which is an anti-epilepsy drug because I had massive epilepsy. So basically, we went to Dublin and asked, is there anything to be done in the moment? They said, nope, there's absolutely nothing you could do. I went with a girlfriend to London. And we went round and toured a couple of hospitals, big neurology units in London. Nope, there's nothing that can be done for you, I'm afraid. It is just not operable. We do not have that. You will die on the operating theatre. You cannot, we can't help you. So, you know, I'm at the point where now I have written letters to Nicola for when she's 10, you know, 16, 18, her wedding. I've got all of that done and I have a will made and, you know, starting to kind of take responsibility and to believe that this may be true. But at the 11th hour, actually, it was my sister-in-law on Nick's side. She had a neighbor who had a neurology. It's a long story, but anyway, a surgeon in Bristol was sent my scans. And in those days, they were enormous things. There were no discs then. And he wrote to me and he basically said, dear Mrs. Gatto, I'll give it a go. But if you survive surgery, you need to know that you're more than likely be paralyzed down the left side of your body. So let me know. Yours sincerely. So I didn't have to think about it very much. I wanted to be alive. I was young, but I also wanted to be there for Nicola. I couldn't leave her. And, you know, and I didn't even think about being paralyzed. But the thought of somebody giving me a chance, I went for it. And I had one last Christmas with Nicola and they wanted me before Christmas. And I said, no. I wanted to be with Nicola for one Christmas, just in case. And I had a preparatory surgery in London first, which was gluing shut a couple of arteries to make the surgery safer and the potential of me surviving it greater. I developed most awful serious seizures from that. And so I was on a lot of medication. And then in January, we went for the major op and it was a major op. And I survived, of course, I'm here. I was very ill. And I was paralyzed. And the trauma of waking up after about 12 days of being sedated and not being able to turn over in the bed was horrific, I will only say. Horrific, because I thought about it later, I could escape everything up until then. Somehow I was able to kind of keep going and keep the plate spinning and not ever have to reflect on what I was feeling or what indeed I was going through or anything. I just kept going. And then I was trapped in a bed. And then there was shame. There was guilt. There was horror. There was no privacy. There was no freedom. There was no escape. There was no me anymore. Now my life was different again. And I clearly remember that moment of going, it's over now. It's really over. I put my hands up. You know, I can't do anymore now. But I didn't stay like that for long.
I often hear that when people have, you know, loss in their life and significant, and, you know, I remember it myself, the go, 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 go. Let's get busy and ignore it all.
Just keep the show going.
Just keep going. And I used to laugh at my sister when her husband died, before she died. She was alive for a year when her husband died. We used to laugh because she'd say, I think I might paint the sitting room. I'd be like, okay. The following day, I think I'll put carpet on the stairs. I need to go to the shop. Do you want to come? I'd be like, okay, what are you going for? I need to buy a toothbrush. She was just go, 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 don't stop. And I get it. And you know what? There's nothing wrong with that either. If that's what gets you through those early days,
100%.
It is okay. Mm. However, then all of a sudden, when you if you have to stop and you're alone with your thoughts.
Oh.
Oof. It can be grim, right?
Yeah, it can. Just to go back to the your sister's coping for 1 second.
Yeah.
One of my coping was ironing, right? I took up ironing with gusto. And I remember I was ironing J cloths when a girlfriend called around and she said to me, what the are you doing? And I said, I'm ironing my J cloths. And she took the whole lot of them, right? Opened the window and threw them out the window. And she goes, you will not iron a J cloth. I don't care what you're going to, but we're not ironing J cloths. So I totally get her. I'll put carpet in. I'll do this. You know, it's
so funny.
It's not a thing to do. It's instrumental. It's so funny.
Yeah, it is funny.
It is funny because, yeah. I mean, obviously humor gets us through a lot of it anyway, as we said earlier, but
it's when you look at yourself because you think, oh my God, you're cracked. What are you doing?
Yeah. But coping.
You're doing that because you have to, because the pain of it is too great.
Yeah.
And you can't go there.
Yeah. So you could spend a lot of money though, couldn't you?
This is the thing. I was like, we were all like, she's going to be bankrupt. Yeah. That lady. She was doing a picture wall.
Yeah. She was gone. Everything changing.
Everything.
My life has changed, so I'm going to change everything
just
in my
everything.
Life.
Everything. It was hilarious. But, so I suppose, tell me then, was it, Nicola was 5 at this stage. Did it all, for lack of a better term, catch up on you? Did it all come to the surface? All of that grief and loss?
It did to a degree. However, there was another level of trauma that came from a brain injury that screwed my head up. And when somebody has opened your head and tinkered around, you're not the same.
Okay.
When you come back from that, you are altered. And there's a lot of evidence now that they know it's a bit like open heart surgery, messes with your emotions. And my emotions were completely and utterly unbridled at that point. I could not stop crying. I cried and cried and cried. And I had no idea why I was crying. I don't know whether it was because they'd been tinkering in my brain or because I was bereft and grieving of what happened. But there was a whole other layer of trauma. And also, I was told, we don't know if you'll ever walk again. We don't know if you'll ever use your arm again. I was left-handed. And so I was really busy. I'd lost the use of my left hand, my dominant hand. So I had to learn very quickly to start using my right hand. And I don't know if you've ever tried, but, you know, like just brush your teeth with your non-dominant hand. It is really difficult. So I was employed with learning how to live a different way again. So there was a whole other layer of learning and trauma after all of the traumatic learnings that I'd already had. So to some respects, I was emotionally unbound. I wailed and cried and I was raging as well. I was so angry that I'd allowed myself to have this surgery because I was fine until the surgery. I was kept saying, I was fine until I had the surgery. And everybody was saying, yes, but it wasn't going to last. You were not going to stay and you were very symptomatic and I was on a lot of medication. So I had all of this row going on. So I was having to come to terms with a new version of Rachel and I hadn't got to know the version of Rachel that was going to develop as a result of Dominic dying, as a result of being a mom, as a result of being a widow. I was only really just getting to know a little bit about me. And then that part of me disappeared. I became something completely different overnight again. So I was so foreign to myself and so foreign to who I should be, could be. And my brain was all over the place. I was on a lot of medication. I couldn't walk. I couldn't use my arm. And I was transferred to a brain injury unit. And that was a very difficult time. And what I do remember is shame, which is when we look at why would I be ashamed? I was ashamed if I was tired. So I would try and not be tired. I would try and stay awake all day, but actually I needed to sleep a lot. We know you need to sleep a lot with a brain injury. But there was all of this conflict going on in me of not being good enough. Not fitting the grade, not being somebody or something or achieving. Or there was a narrative that was going on that caused me to overwork, overtry, overgive, overdo everything. I just became the person in the unit who would sit with the people who were sad. I formed another role that was something that I needed, or I needed confirmation that I was still a good person. I think it ripped the last vestiges of any portion of my growing personality as a mom, as a person. So I had to begin again in the most fundamental way. It really was. There are so many words, but you know, there's a word we say, discombobulating, which kind of is almost humorous, but it was extremely discombobulating given what I'd already been through. And it meant that what I'd been through was kind of sidelined again. It didn't have a place. And I didn't know how to give it place because I was having to learn how to be in the world. If that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. I think a big factor as well is you were so young when all this was happening. And if you think about it, it's like you didn't get the chance to become who you would have been, as you said, should have been, could have been, because your identity kept changing. I'm the girl who lost her brother. No, wait, I'm the girl who lost her husband, was pregnant. No, wait, I'm not. I'm the person who has a brain injury. And it's like, as you say, the only word for that is discombobulating. Like it was really difficult. Because who am I? I suppose was kind of maybe what you felt.
Mm. And I felt a burden.
Did you?
I felt I'd taken up everyone's airtime. You know, I'd already had my brothers and my mom and everybody support me through this. And now I couldn't even feed myself, literally, you know. And they were taking in turns to come to England because I was still in the hospital in England and the unit. And I think the shame stems from needing to rely on other people physically. And that's what I think it stems from. And
that's interesting.
Yeah. Being a burden is a really tough one. And as you rightfully said, I was very young, you know, and you know, all of this sort of phase, should we put it, this period of my life, it was nearly 20 years between all of it. And it's like a chunk of personal development was not there. I didn't have the usual milestones. And I remember a woman wrote to me after Nick died, and this letter terrified me. And I think I still have this letter, and I'd like to read it again. Is she very wisely wrote, "You've had so many titles in your life so far, Rachel. You've been a daughter, a sister, a businesswoman, And now you assume the title of widow."
Oh, God.
Yeah. And it, you know, it really was a ridiculously weird letter to receive. But now I'm 57. I get what she was trying to say. I get that she was trying to kind of...
I'm like, what was she trying to say?
I get she could see me from the outside. And she could see that I was living experiences. And that someday I would be something because of it, not despite it. That's what I choose to see now. At the time, it terrified me. I looked at it and screamed, like, what extra burden are you trying to hand me here? But I do think that she had some wisdom that I obviously, in my young age, didn't know. I was only 30 at that stage, 29, 30. And then with the brain injury, I was 34. So actually, what happened after I left the brain injury unit and returned to Ireland was, I had no use of my left arm at all. It was completely dead. I was limping on my left leg. I had started to walk. I wanted to go home to Ireland. I wanted to get away. I wanted to escape. I wanted to be back in my home. And I wanted my own bed and I wanted to be near my daughter. But when I got back, I developed intractable seizures that were so serious that I was having up to 12 a day. I had such massive brain injury scarring. It didn't show up for a long time. And then my world closed in then, because the only way of dealing with this was to keep adding in medication after medication until I stopped seizing every day. But what that did was it put me into a spellbound world. I was removed from reality then. So I couldn't feel anything anymore, the rawness, the pain, the process. So I was like an empty vessel then, because I was mentally bludgeoned and I needed that medication at the time. I'm not complaining. It kept me alive. However, it put the bung in the process for a period of about 9 years. So Nicola lived with a mother who really only had a very fine range of emotions, which was removal and rage. Sadness and rage. I could only range between extremes. I had no nuance. I used to look at people laughing and mimic them because I couldn't feel anything. I used to pretend to have fun. I didn't even really know I was doing that. I formed a fantasy way of living that lasted for many, many years. And I talked to Nicola about it. How did you? She said, well, I didn't know any other way. You know, I didn't know another mom, but I was not a mom in the way we'd imagine. You know, I was loving, but I always felt I was acting it. I could never really get in touch with those feelings. I knew what to do. But that went on for 7, 8 years. And then I started to really, really get lower and lower and lower and lower until I figured out this isn't going to work anymore. I can't live like this anymore. I couldn't feel. I could barely stay awake during the day because I couldn't sleep during the night. I couldn't feel Nicola. I couldn't feel anybody. I was drinking a lot. I was smoking. I was operating like somebody who was avoiding, but it wasn't that I was avoiding. I was chemically had a lobotomy and there was a lot going on inside me, but I had no way of getting near it. I couldn't touch it.
You know, having been on antidepressants for a period of time myself, when I look back, it's so hard because when you're in it, it's kind of hard to fathom if it's helping you or not.
Mm.
On reflection, it definitely, my mood was extremely low and it took me up to the middle, right? So if you imagine the top of a ladder is in great form, the bottom is in the worst form. I was just in the middle and I remember that sense of I am unable to laugh.
Yeah.
That really resonated when you said that because I was like, I was pretending, I'd be like, and I remember, I don't knock the drugs because it took me from that really low place, it really did, where I was like, I just feel so low. It took me up, but I was numb and I didn't feel sad, but I also didn't feel happy or joy at all. And it wasn't until, I think I was on them for about 2 years. Again, I'm not knocking them. They definitely helped me to come up. But when I came off them and actually, you know, when you burst laughing, I was like, wow, I haven't done that in years.
It's visceral. You feel it.
Yeah. And it's not that I didn't want to. I just couldn't, as you said, I couldn't reach it.
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder, you know about it, but you're not feeling it.
It's really hard, isn't it? Because yeah. I wonder how many people in life are in that stage and just aren't able to feel or touch that true joy.
100%. Or the true pain.
Yeah.
And that's it, isn't it? Because pain is pain.
Yeah.
And it feels fairly scary and fairly dark.
Yeah.
And sometimes we're not ready or we're not able, or some people don't even ever want to feel it. And that's all part of the journey. I wanted to feel. I knew I was told that I would never survive without the meds. And I was at that point, I was on 6 medications 4 times a day prescribed. They were all different versions of mood stabilizers.
And all for your brain, you see.
All for my brain.
Yeah.
Yeah. But what we didn't do was explore, do I still need that level? That was never really reviewed. So I just was going downhill badly. And I knew I was slipping. I knew that this was not good for Nicola. I was not behaving like a mum should. And I was drinking more because actually, when I drank, I felt I could feel. And I found out years later that actually one of the drugs was a benzodiazepine, and alcohol sits on the same receptor as a benzodiazepine. And you need more and more and more of benzodiazepines for them to work. They're all the diazepams, the, you know, Valium, Xanax, clonazepam, all the PAMs are benzodiazepines. And they have dual purpose, but mostly they're supposed to be used for acute care. So 2 weeks max. I'd been on one of them for 7 years. And so I was chronically in withdrawal. We didn't know this. And chronic withdrawal can create the most horrific symptoms of withdrawal. So depression, anxiety, inability to sleep, muscle spasms, you know, huge anxiety, panic attacks. This is what I was all experiencing. So I kind of started asking, you know, like, I went to a neurologist and I said, it's been these amount of years. Is it possible that this, what I'm experiencing, is medication in any way? And when they looked at my history and my medical diagnosis and everything, no, you've got a massive brain injury, you know, and it's unlikely you'll ever be able to manage without less. So it went on and on and on until I was simply scared for myself. And so I did some research and I figured out that one of the drugs was one of these, what we call benzodiazepines. And but kind of then I asked a neurologist, you know, if there was one drug here, would there be one you'd say is a culprit in any way? Or, you know, I was trying to find out. And he said that one might be a problem. And it was the benzo. And I said, what do I do? And the response was, just stop taking them. I did very quickly. And within hours, I was in a very serious state. I was sweating. I had what I imagined were beetles running around my arms. I thought I had worms in my mouth. I was hearing things. I was absolutely delusional. I was off my head, for want of a better word. I'd already been off my head, but I was really off my head. And I just knew enough to take the drug, and I took it again, and then I was back to where I was. So that was information. And so, again, like bereavement, there was very little about benzodiazepine dependence in those days. There wasn't much in the internet for me to read, but I did find a forum of people who were all trapped in the same wicket as me, which was accidental drug addiction, which is another thing I add to my CV, if we're being smart about it. But it was a very serious time for me because I had to experiment to see, could I come off the drug and get off without having seizures? And to cut the story short, it took me 2.5 years to come off this one drug. And I had no support, medical support, because they thought it was psychological, that I had a psychological illness. But I knew, because I'd got the textbooks that I could find, I knew what I was going through was serious, and I knew it was very difficult. The symptoms that I experienced were so horrific. I have a journal that I wrote, and you know, I was quite mad. I became psychotic. I imagined that people hated me. I couldn't make eye contact with anyone. And I lived the life of more or less of a recluse for 2 years in my farmhouse. I wasn't allowed to drive. I'd had a seizure. Neighbours would take Nicola to the school. But I couldn't meet people. I couldn't be with people. And the only outing I had every week was to go and see my therapist, who genuinely kept me alive. She'd sell me twice a week and I would just rant my mania to her and I would get back and go. And I was imprisoned in my mind. And we can, you know, we know that benzodiazepine withdrawal is particularly horrific. It messes with every aspect of your physicality, your psychic mind, your spirituality, your everything gets brought into, because the receptors are screaming for more of the drug. And it's not the type of drug you can just go cold turkey like heroin or cocaine, because you're physically dependent on it. So you have to incrementally reduce it. Let the receptors get used to it. Every 2 weeks, a small, small percentage. The journey I went on then, I think that everything that had happened to me came into my world in my head. And I had to battle the demons of what the voices were saying day in, day out, night after night after night after night. And in my diary, I wrote, you know, I wait patiently for sleep to come and it will only drape itself around me at its own bidding. You know, I was completely at the mercy of what happened to me. And yet I kept going. I didn't go back on the drugs and lead the kind of the spellbound life that I had. I kept forging. I kept pushing. I kept going. Every 2 weeks, I would drop the dose. And every 2 weeks, I'd have madness for a couple of days. And then it would be just physical and misery and misery. And I went on like that for 2 years until I got to the last dose. And the only reason I survived it, I believe, is because of a forum of people all going through the same thing. We all shared the horror together. And this is really ostensibly what I'm coming to, is about shared experiences. There was no one to share that experiences. There was no one to share that experience and so on. And I think that when we're talking about bereavement and loss and all of these things now, we know very well how that sharing the story, it changes everything. And sharing my story with those people on the internet, the people I never met, changed how I survived and how I began again.
Wow.
I'm so grateful, and this could sound cliched and trite, and it is not. I'm so grateful for that experience. As horrific as it was, I met me in the rawest of paces sitting on that stairs for 2 years. There is no way there is any part of me that wasn't stripped back, that didn't have to face the truth of me and who I really am, and have the arguments and the denigration and the judgments and the harshness. It all went on in my head. I heard it all. So when I came through that phase, I was humble. You know, I really was. I hadn't been out for a while, a couple of years. I hadn't socialized. You know, it was the beginning again. It was simply the dawning of a new era from the day that Dominic got sick to that day when I took the last of those drugs. Then I began again.
When you got to that day, I suppose, when you finally were off the benzos, was it positive, or was it now you're gone, or, you know, you've slowly, is the horror of coming off that drug along the way, or is it at, you know, day zero, or is that a positive thing that now you're coming out from the smoke?
It was very positive.
Okay.
Yeah. I remember Nicola pointing at me and going, you smiled. And oh. I did smile. And I remember a girlfriend who called to me irregularly, but she called to me and she would drive me to the beach and we'd walk the beach. And I remember her clearly saying to me, what would you like to have again, Rachel? What would you like to have in your life? And I remember saying to her, I would like to smile. I would just like to smile again. So when Nicola said to me, you smiled, I know I smiled that day, but I didn't just smile with my face. I smiled because I could see the sun. I could feel. I could, like, I knew that the change was coming. I just knew that it was different now. And I feel as if almost, you know, you kind of like, there's a big storm behind you and you suddenly walk into the sunshine. I knew, I didn't expect life would be roses, but I knew me. I knew a version of me. And I knew the version of me that was there in that moment was going to be a hell of a lot better version of me that wouldn't have happened, been, if I had, that hadn't happened. I think that I was in danger of continuing being the same person. Not that I was a bad person, but I don't think I was growing. Maybe I didn't have time to grow. Maybe I'm being very harsh on myself. But when I came out, that was the, it was May 2013, the 27th of May 2013. I just knew that I was going to walk through a different era, and I'd done some work. You know, I'd lived with it in my head for so long. And I recovered so quickly. I was like socially inept. I had to learn how to socialize again. I had people had fallen away. I had to really reinvent my life. But I reinvented it in a way that I feel was commensurate with who I was destined to be this time. That I had to go through that. That I had to suffer that to grow as this person. That's my belief. I really believe it.
Yeah. It's like, you know, from, I suppose, the day Dominic got sick and you started to care for him all the way up to this point in 2013, it's almost like, it's like one big storm and you were stuck in it and you couldn't come out. Like, you know, and in that sense, then when you're trying to be all these people, be a mother, be a friend, be a colleague, whatever it is, you're not able to because you're not you. You're in the middle of this storm. And it just sounds like I totally can visualize that, that like, okay, here I am. Mm. I'm back in the living, in the real world.
Yeah, I'm back on this planet. And I'm me because I can feel.
Yeah, you can feel.
You know, I can feel myself. Yeah. I can feel Nicola. I can feel something for Nicola. It's very different.
Tell me then, did you, you know, because your eyes are now opened, did you have guilt around Nicola? You know, when you're saying, I can feel. Has that been something you've had to deal with in the aftermath of all these storms, if you want to put it that way?
Yeah.
Did you look back and feel parts of shame or guilt because of that?
I did.
Yeah.
I really did. But I got better at it for me insofar as I was paddling, you know, hard. So I was doing the best I could. I'm very clear on that now. For Nicola, I really felt that I had to say, for what you had to experience, I am sorry. You know, I couldn't really do any better than I did. Yeah. I feel so guilty that I drank and smoked when I was pregnant. And she did, you know, say to me like, Mom, and, you know, I'm saying, I know, and I am sorry. It was the only thing I could do to keep myself together. We have a marvelous relationship. We have a great equal relationship now. She has been through so much, obviously. She is a very sunny-sided person, very independent, as you can imagine. She's traveled a lot. And we're really proud of each other. I think that's the richness of us. And we have real conversation. We have real connection insofar as there is no mom-daughter. We are mom and daughter, and I know that I'm her protector. But we went way beyond that very young. You know, she had to care for me. Things weren't right. So I would spoil her for the rest of my life, you know, but I spoil her, I hope, with enough of the me now. And she's so proud of what I've done since.
Aww.
You know, she always wanted a mom who was going to go to the football match, or I never did. So now I'm the mom she wanted, you know, and I'm proud of that for her and for me. It's really important that she sees that, you know, she doesn't have to mind me anymore. That I'm back minding her. You know, where we have the balance right now. I'm the mum again, and, you know, she's my gorgeous, wonderful daughter, you know.
That's so lovely. Can you tell me, I suppose, just before, I want to get into a little bit of the work that you do now. What was the biggest thing, really, that you learned from what you went through? Like, what's, when you look back at that time, and I'm thinking of, you know, young women who've lost their husbands now, or young husbands who've lost their wives, or anybody who's lost a child, or who has been bereaved in whatever way or loss, and they're in the storm and they can't laugh and they can't smile and they can't cope. They're just about coping. Mm. They're not able to care. They're not able to get out of bed. Mm. What's your thoughts on that for people that are kind of in that phase now? What did you learn, or what words of advice would you have for someone like that now?
Mm. That's a lot. Mm. I think the one thing is that bereavement, funny enough, is very noisy inside us. It brings all of our vulnerabilities, our fragilities into the forefront, as well as what we're going through. So we can feel so judgmental of ourselves internally. It's like suddenly the stop cocks are off, and now we can really throw, you know, rocks and eggs and tomatoes at ourselves internally. It's a very noisy sort of experience, although on the outside it can look very quiet. I think that if at all possible, you just hone some narrative, some words for yourself that you are doing the best you can in this moment. I think that we must try to have an inner governor, an inner voice that is louder than our judgments of how we did something or how we didn't do something or how we behaved, that we have something that says, no, that's not true. You are doing your best. The thing about loss and bereavement, and you will know this so well, is that actually we know how to grieve. If we step out of it, our body will grieve for us. It will allow the pain in for a while. It'll allow the numbness for a while. It'll allow us to distract for a while. It may even allow us to laugh for a while. And we repeat that in varying orders or ascending orders continually through the acute phase of grief. And then it lengthens out as we go into young grief and then mature grief. It's about how we can speak to ourselves in the most acute phases, how we can tend to ourselves, how we can have kindness internally. Because the body knows what to do, really. It's about stepping away from judging what the body is doing. Because so many people contact me and they say, I haven't cried for weeks. Am I wrong? Or what's wrong with me, or what's wrong with my experience? And the thing is, as we said earlier, you know, the body intuitively knows when to allow you enough of this, enough of this, and enough of this. So if we know that and we respond to that, then we can be kinder and softer about the experience. And it's about also, if we can, finding a language, which I 1000% did not have, of, I'm not doing so okay today. Do you think you might? I feel I may be leaning on you too much. Would it be all right still if I ask you for this? That we find a language that is commensurate with checking in, but also letting people know our vulnerabilities at the same time, and having some communication, some way of sharing and downloading what we're going through with somebody we trust, that we can know, that they know can hear the awfulness of what we want to say, and that they won't run away from us, that they will stay. But they would be three things that I would really say they're fundamental. They're not going to fix. They're not going to shift us fundamentally from one place to the next, but they are going to give us a small bit of a roadmap. There are many, many other things, of course, that we can incorporate. But I think the inner support, our inner voice, that we get really strong on that, that we understand that grieving and bereavement, our body knows how to do it. So whatever we're experiencing, within obvious reasons, if we're safe, then this is the process. This will happen. This is going to happen. And then this trusted presence, somebody that we can download to, if it's twice a week or even once a week, that we know that we can go to for, should we say, 1 hour or less, even half an hour, to express ourselves deeply without fear of being judged, and importantly, as we all know, without somebody jumping in and comparing or needing to fix, that we find that person. And it can be professional, it can be a group, it can be a coach, it can be a therapist, it can be an online. It's just being heard is so important. If I'd have been heard, I know my journey would have been different. I didn't know how to be heard, and this is no judgment on anyone around me. Just, we didn't have the language.
It was the 90s.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't imagine, I imagine it was nothing like this.
No, no.
There was no in-depth public conversation.
No, I did go to a therapist once. Oh, I did. I went twice, actually. The first one, she was lovely, very kind, but she said she was here to shine a light on my problems. She was the illuminator. She terrified me. I went away. I actually thought I was going to go and sit and cry. And I went away, held my tears in because I didn't want to upset her and her decision of how it was going to be, and was terrified. Didn't go back. Next person I went to, who had a particular type of therapy, and I asked, could I just sit? I just wanted to be in the room with somebody who would just sit with me. And she said, no, you have to be doing some work. So she wouldn't let me come either. So, you know, that kind of is, I'm sure, is not unique. And it has happened to lots of people, that unskilled help can be, you know, really, really, really damaging.
Yeah, for sure.
We need training in this area in every aspect.
Which brings me to the work that you do now. So you have made it your life choice, I suppose, to work in this area, I suppose, as have I. So, you know, I like to, I don't know, I the whole process of grief for me didn't scare me, I suppose. I came to understand that it's okay. And I just see a lot of people struggling with it, or society in general totally misunderstanding it and not equipped to support or help people or have a language around it, which is why I do what I do. The work that you do now, obviously you're a fantastic speaker, and in like even in a corporate setting you're amazing, even at the workshops you could just see everybody was spellbound by you. You're a great storyteller. The clinical hypnotherapy, what brought you into that line of work, and what is it?
Okay. Actually, it was because I learned to become right-handed and I was naturally left-handed. It's neural circuitry. So how did I learn to use my right hand? I had to focus on my right hand, and basically I built new neurons that went around my brain injury and started to link to my right hand. So I became fascinated with how did I actually even learn to use my hand again, because there's a massive scar on the area, the motor area of my brain. My brain very cleverly went round the scar and started to rewire again. So, I mean, I don't have perfect use of it, but I have good enough use of it. That interested me. And then I got to thinking about how I came through the brain injury, and then I came through drug addiction, and how I reformed my inner world, because I, you know, connected to spirituality. This is in my recovery. I connected to sort of Buddhist practices. I connected to yoga. I connected to, you know, talk therapy. Lots of things were starting to feel right. But the day I woke up and I knew that I was going to do something, I wanted to do something that kind of fit what I'd brain work and neuroscience and all of this. And it was clinical hypnotherapy. And then I started to think, okay, if we can use this to mitigate pain, because clinical hypnotherapy is used a lot for pain relief and lots of other symptoms, because the body, mind are all connected. It's not one is separate. And we know that our thoughts create our reality, and our thoughts are naturally negative. We actually, 90% of our thoughts arise every day negatively. We have a lot of negativity. So I learned that actually you can transform that by simply overwriting it with positive thoughts. Takes a bit of a process. But then I got thinking about people who are suffering from depression and anxiety, and how does that work with the brain then? Isn't that, you know, something that we can work on? And I trained as a clinical hypnotherapist, and I immediately specialized in trauma. I immediately specialized in helping people to calm the brain down, calm the amygdala, use breath work, use positive unconscious suggestions, which is what the unconscious mind is. It is the fountain, the wealth of our emotions and our feelings. So we've got 5% of the mind is the conscious mind, and that's your wishes, desires, your needs mind. That's your lateral thinking mind. It's your New Year's resolution mind. However, by the middle of January, you're no longer in your resolution. You're back to the old patterns. Why? Because the emotional mind, which is the unconscious mind, holds the beliefs. And our beliefs create our emotions, and our emotions create our habits of action. So to me, it seems logical that if we have depression or anxiety, we want to know what the emotional and feeling components of those are. Where did they stem from? And most of our beliefs about ourselves and the world around us and our lives come and are acquired in our early attachment phase before the ages of about 8. So clinical hypnotherapy has a funny connotation because you see the movies and stage hypnosis. Actually, it's a very powerful healing modality that is basically neuroscience backed. So we can get to the root cause of your issue very swiftly by putting you into a focused state of mind, asking the brain, where does this stem from? Where did you originally begin to feel less than, not good enough, not lovable? Because all of those fundamental beliefs about ourselves cloud our world. So if we have a fundamental belief that we acquired through negative parenting and denigrative parenting, that stays there. We don't grow out of it. And it comes with us into our adult world. And so we are holding these beliefs internally. So when something bad happens to us, if we have a belief that I'm not worthy, well, of course you're not worthy. You deserve this to happen to you. You are not a good person, and so on and so on. So we change the inner belief, the inner voice, the inner negative, judgmental critic, quite literally. And how we do that is I do the work with the client under hypnosis, finding the root cause, identifying it, discrediting it, because the brain does not know the difference between the past, the present, or the future. It simply runs programs like a computer disk. You are not worthy. You are not worthy, but it's silent. You can't hear it, but it has a really strong effect on every decision you make. So we discredit it. We say, that's not me anymore. I'm not that kid anymore. I'm a grown-up 57-year-old woman now. I have agency. I'm free of that. I'm not that kid trapped in that dysfunctional home. And then we know through neuroscience that the brain only learns how to do something through repetitive thought or action. That's how at the gym we get strong muscles. The same in the brain. We repeat the same positive information to the brain over and over. I record a bespoke hypnosis audio for each client designed around what happened in the session, the issues they're working with, and we turn them around, and the client listens every day and they go into hypnosis every day because I bring them into hypnosis through the audio. So it has a very quickly transformative effect. So I worked in trauma and crisis for the first 4 or 5 years. And then I started to get clients who were suffering from prolonged grief disorder. They could not move on. They were still caught in that time. And of course, we can put them into hypnosis. We can ask, where did it stem from? And then we can reframe. I've had so many clients really, really stuck in their grieving process. We do not, incidentally, go near grief in the early years. It's not something that we fix. So this only is apparent, and this is only where we work when somebody is 5, 6 years down the line, maybe more. And it's often 15 to 20 when they come to me. And sometimes they come to me with depression and anxiety, and it stems from a bereavement earlier that was unresolved. So it's very tender work. It's very intuitive work. But what we can do is we can free that stuck feeling, that stuck event. I had one person, this is going back many, many years, and I'm going to change the circumstances a little bit just so the person is identifiable, was locked out of the bedroom of the grandma dying at age 3. And that being locked out of that process had left her in a very, very stuck, bereft state, but also her imagination could hear everything. So while she was under hypnosis, we were able to go to that and we were able to transform the scene to give her power. We were able to open the door, allow her to get a step and look in at the person who was dying and say what she needed to say. That had a transformative effect on this person who actually incidentally was in their 60s at this point. It was a very, very long time ago. So we don't know what is stuck. But the brilliance about the mind is the mind knows exactly where the stuckness began. And hypnotherapy, you're not unconscious, you're not controlled, you're not going anywhere. You're actually not doing anything you don't do every single day yourself. Because everybody's driven home and gone, you know, how did I get home? I can't remember those lights, the roundabout. Because you're coming home on a program, your mind knows the way home. And it's the same with the disagreements or the disease of the mind is, we're running programs all the time that are clouding our lives. So we're all going in the same direction. All types of therapy are heading to the unconscious drivers. It's just with hypnotherapy, we can go there much quicker.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's powerful stuff.
Yeah, it's very effective. And the more I've been, I've seen 550 clients, possibly one-to-one about it this time, the more I realize, you know, the power of it. And the power, interestingly, of me not knowing what's going to happen. Yesterday, I declined. I have to steel myself to not know what I'm doing because there is a natural journey that comes from this. We both go on this journey and it is over when it's over. Yesterday, my client was with me for 5 hours. I come out of that completely refreshed and on a high. And my client, maybe not quite so because it's very emotional. It can be very tiring. But they write themselves over the next few days. And I'm there. I'm checking in all the time. You know,
transformative, isn't it?
Yeah. It's very, it's very different.
It's what you needed as opposed to the drugs.
Yeah. It's what I needed as opposed to the drugs. But to me, it's really exciting.
Very, yeah.
You know, it really is. And I work with grief coaching as well, practical tools. I'm an instrumental person. I want to know, how do we get here? How do we get out of here? How do we get out of Dodge? Of course, we want to tend to the emotions, but I want to know how I'm going to tend to my emotion and how am I going to get from A to B. So that's the way I work, is I'm pretty instrumental. I'm very emotionally aware and connected, but I hated being stuck. I hated that impotence. I did not like that grief ran me. And you can't outrun grief. We know that. It has its own journey. But if we have something that we can tend to, like for one thing, I always say to clients, if you're feeling desperately overwhelmed, child's pose, go down to the ground. The ground will always hold you. The ground will never let you down. Just go down and just be there. And whatever comes up, you're held. You're held by the ground and you're held by yourself. And just allow. If I had have known that if I could just fall to the ground, I would have had less holding, because the energy it takes to grieve is immense. So these are the sort of things I think that we have to have a toolbox.
Yes. Yeah.
Because what works today doesn't work tomorrow. What might work now might not work in an hour. So if we have a range of things that we have that feel right for us, they're not somebody else's tools, but that we pick and choose them, because this journey is going to be immense and it's going to be lengthy, but it will not always feel like this.
Mm. Absolutely, yeah. Thank you so much for sharing all of that wisdom. It's really, really helpful and I'm sure it will help people. I'm just conscious of time, so unfortunately I could go for at least another 2 hours here now looking into this side of things, but where can people find you if they'd like to find out more or to work with you? Where's the best place to find you?
Well, Instagram, I'm at Rachel V. Gotto. So I am trying to get better at doing reels and being, I'm usually a writer. I'm a writing person, but I'm trying to get better at tips and tools and strategies. So if you're interested in more instrumental stuff, that would be a great place to hang out with me.
And your website too is pretty good. I saw it. It's rachelgotto.com.
Yeah, yeah, it is. Yeah.
I'll put all the links into the notes anyway, if anyone would like to reach out. And thank you so much for being here today and sharing you know, all of the stages of the storm of life that you have been through, but also the hope that you will give people, that you're able to sit across from me and share that experience in such a positive, confident way now, and in a position that you're helping people. What a transformation, you know. It's just proves to people that you can keep going and you can thrive, actually. But thank you so, so much for being here today, Rachel.
Oh, it is honestly the greatest pleasure. It really is. Thank you for inviting me, really.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
That's it for this week's episode. Thank you all so much for listening. Also, a huge thanks to our sponsors at flowers.ie for supporting the pod. This Mother's Day, whether you're celebrating your mammy or remembering her in a special way, let flowers.ie help you mark the day. You get that peace of mind with their video approval on every single order and fast and efficient express delivery in County Dublin and surroundings, and next day delivery to all counties. With 15,000 five-star reviews, you know you're in good hands. So visit flowers.ie today, and don't forget to use that promo code 5STAR to get €5 off. It's Ireland's highest rated florist for a reason. 5STAR, luxury flowers approved by you, delivered with care. Thanks again to them and to you. I will talk to you all next week.
Family flowers only. Thanks to flowers.ie. 5STAR luxury flowers. Approved by you. Delivered with care.